All right, so today what we're going to do is we're going to, I'm supposed to be doing a survey or a high level walkthrough of the Old Testament and New Testament in the next 2 weeks. So what you're going to get is a compressed version of 66 books in 2 hours. I'm kidding, you're not going to get that. It's actually an administrative oversight on my side. For the past few times when I've taught, is it recorded?
Yep.
When I've taught this class, I've actually taken 7 weeks to do something like this. And when Jason sent the schedule out, I totally assumed that was taken into consideration. And I saw 2 weeks, I was like, yeah, okay, whatever, right? And then once I actually sat down to prepare, I was like, wait, I have 2 weeks. What am I supposed to do? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go as far as we can go without actually rushing us. And then anything that's left over, we'll plan for the second semester, which is our January to May semester. So you may get just a portion of the Old Testament for these 2 weeks, and then we'll work on the remainder of the Old Testament and the New Testament for the weeks afterwards. Now, as you know, and I'm hoping you've got your caffeine in, because I'm going to ask more questions today. It's not going to be a PowerPoint. We have the canon. So Jeremy taught us about the canon 2 weeks ago. Not the gun. What's the canon?
66 books of the Bible. Yeah.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. But what is? We could have just said the Bible. Why did we say the canon?
Like a rule or a standard.
A rule or a standard of what? You're a star. Okay. Of what? A rule or standard of what? Okay, let me ask you this. A kilometer is a standard of what?
Measure.
Measuring what?
Distance.
Distance. Okay, so the canon is a rule or standard of what?
Measuring veracity.
Is it a measure of veracity?
I would imagine so, because why?
65 books there also have veracity. Just knock Jude out of the canon. There's still veracity.
I did a horrible job.
No, we actually learn in layers. So yes. sometimes we learn, we get a lesson, and what happens with learning is we actually, the teacher has 100 units, the teacher teaches probably 80 units, and the students absorb probably 10 units. And so we often repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat to keep building up. Right, and some of our students, by the way, have taken this class multiple times because they say, hey, we've gone through it once, but we've only captured kind of one layer. We want to go again to capture a second layer. So if you don't remember what it's a standard for, don't worry. All right, I'm just asking the question to make you feel uncomfortable, to help you realize there's still, like, the ceiling isn't here yet. The ceiling is a little bit more, and you can still grow even with the lessons that you've had. So the 66 books... that Dave said, the 66 books, how are they broken down?
Old and New Testaments.
All right. Okay, how are they broken down?
History, minor prophets, major prophets.
Oh, just give me a simpler one than that.
Okay.
Torah. Like,
okay, much,
asking,
much,
or?
No.
Okay.
How are 66 broken down here? It's not 33 and 33.
Oh, 39?
39? I ask much, much simpler questions. Okay, and? What's the math? You're Indian. You should get it. No, I'm kidding.
27.
Okay. All right. So we have 30 and 27. So did you know that there's some Old Testament in the New Testament? So the New Testament is just an artificial breakdown of books. It's not a breakdown of the story. What does testament mean? What does testament mean?
The covenant?
Yeah, exactly. Means covenant. Okay. So did you know that there's Old Covenant also in the New Testament? John the Baptist, Old Covenant or New Covenant?
Old.
Old. But where do you read a John the Baptist?
Yeah.
In the New. Right? So Old Testament and New Testament are not divisions of a story. They're divisions of the books. But there's a story that starts from the Old Testament and goes all the way to Revelation and beyond. Right? The story is divided very differently than an Old Testament and New Testament. Right? So we're going to go and map our books to a story that's actually taking place from the beginning to the end. Now, your Old Testament, all of you complex people over here, how's the Old Testament broken down?
There's like the Torah.
Okay.
Is that what you're asking me now?
Well, answer and I'll tell you that's what I'm asking.
I always feel like I'm pronouncing it wrong.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
They're the same thing. So Torah and Pentateuch are the same thing. Okay, with Torah. Okay. So it's a group effort here. Please don't leave your teammates hanging.
Prophets.
Okay.
Maybe story.
Okay, what else do we have?
Psalms.
Psalms, okay. Okay, what else?
Narrative.
Yeah, wisdom.
Historical narrative.
So there's narrative. Okay.
But there's narrative within some of them too. So.
We're all using different ways to classify it. And so you're going to see that there are gaps. Because using Torah is a way to actually classify it. And there are two other terms that classifies the Old Testament. But then when we say narrative, we're actually using something called genre. Genre is a way of understanding any kind of book, right? Or any kind of, even a movie. You can ask, what's a genre in a movie or in a book? So when we ask genre, we have narrative. And then I heard something else. I heard poetry or something like that.
Yeah, poetry.
Poetry, okay.
History, wisdom,
history, history. So there are different kinds of narrative. History. Poetry falls under wisdom. What else? Does anyone know this is a fly graveyard over here? So every time I stand here, all I hear is just like buzzing, 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 buzzing. Yeah.
That's
so,
your tinnitus.
Yeah?
It's not the flies.
It's not. So sorry, I just keep looking over. I'm like, oh, okay. Anything else? All right, so.
Visions, like prophetic visions.
Oh, okay. So. Narrative. Oh, so that's apocalyptic. That's a genre. It's apocalyptic stuff. That's visions and stuff like that. Okay. What else?
Would genealogy be under like history and like narrative, or would that be?
Genealogy. An Australian friend of mine said it's not genealogy, it's genealogy. And I realized Brits pronounce it genealogy, and Americans pronounce it genealogy, depending on.
Biography,
okay. So you're... Biography. You're giving me genres. I need breakdown of the books. I hope you're seeing the difference in the terms you're using versus the terms that are down here, probably.
Can you maybe explain a little bit more about what you're looking for?
Yeah. So we have 39 books. How do I categorize these 39 books?
Major prophets, minor prophets.
Okay, so under prophets we have major and minor. Good. Okay. What about the arrangements of the books? So if I start in Genesis and I keep reading, do I end in Malachi? And does the story end in Malachi? Is that how?
This is the first five, right?
So the first five ends before Canaan. So that's the first five. That's why it's called the Pentateuch. It's the first five. So if I start in Genesis, how come I don't end in Malifaux? Why did they choose to put everything into a blender and blend it up and just spit it out and tie it up to a bundle? Did they have any, did they put any thought through this when they packaged stuff together? What happened to their marketing team?
It happened over a lot of years.
Yeah. I know what it's like at companies when marketing teams come and go. Everyone has a new brand. So obviously that's what happened.
Do you mind rephrasing your question?
Yes. My 39 books. It's either broken down into sections or arranged in a certain way. Like, how do I even start looking at it? Are there categories of how it's broken down? Are they arranged in a certain way? How do I start thinking about these 39 books?
Okay, well, one I can think of is given a hint that I'm genre called wisdom literature.
Okay.
So you have Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes in that category.
Yep.
I think it's categorized that way because it concerns the topic of wisdom.
How many did you name over there?
I think I named four.
Five.
Did I name five? Oh, yes, of course.
Okay. Are we on the right track here?
Yes, you are.
Okay. He's plumbing the depths.
Are there any biblical texts to help us understand how these could be broken down?
Oh yeah, in Luke.
Yes.
At the end, Jesus says the law, prophets, and the Psalms.
Okay. Let's go to it.
Luke 24.
Okay, you could lead us to that. You thought this would be a beginner class, right? Joke's on you.
Oh, yeah. Luke 24, verse 44.
Yes, okay, what does it say?
Then he said to them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled."
Okay, the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled. So Jesus had how many categories? Three categories. You actually started out well, Emma, but nobody actually helped you get across the finish line, right? So you passed and there was a fumble and then it didn't work. So good. So how he would have categorized it is he would have seen the Torah, and then he said prophets, right? The Navi, and then the Psalms is the Ketuvim. So Navim and Ketuvim, which is the Moses' writing, Torah. Navi'im is the prophets, means Navi or Nabi is prophet. Ketuvim are the writings, all right? So that's the way the Hebrew Bible is arranged. So for example, Ruth is not where Ruth is in our English Bibles. Daniel is not where Daniel is in the English Bibles, right? Joshua, Judges, they're not where they are in the English Bibles. They're in a second section. So we have Moses' writings. We have what are known as the lesser prophets and greater prophets. And then we have the writings, which are all of the Psalms and everything. Yes?
Why are they not the same as the Hebrew Bible?
Because there's a rearrangement for a different reason, and I'm going to show it to you now. There's a different way that the Septuagint, or the Greek Bible, not the Hebrew Bible, the Greek Bible is arranged, and we're going to talk about that right now. And this is how it's arranged for the reason that it actually lends itself well to understanding your story. I'm going to get you a printout next week, but I'm going to show this to you now. So an easy way to remember the breakdown of the Old Testament for our English Bibles, which is just like the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, is remember 17, 5, 17. Okay? And for the New Testament, it's 4, 1, 21, 1. If you want to actually do something as a class, I didn't want to actually have us do it, but if there was a different class where we had more time, we would have done 5, 12, 5, 5, 12, 4, 1, 21, 1. That's what we would have done. So 17 forms a certain set of books, 5 sets up a certain kind of books, and 17 forms a certain kind of books. For the New Testament, what do you think these 4 are? This one's easy.
Gospels.
And then what do you think the one is? Acts. Okay, 21.
Letters.
Epistles, yeah. Which means letters, yes. And then?
Revelation.
Now, the 17:5:17 is what's kind of mysterious to us. The 17 is the first 17 books. It's Genesis all the way to Esther. The 5 are Job to Ecclesiastes. And then the 17 here are Isaiah to Malachi. All right, so when I ask the question, how does the story begin? There's no way the story begins in Genesis and ends at Malachi. And the reason why is, if you see the books over here, Esther, Job, and Psalms, they're right next to each other in your Bible. Esther, then the next one is Job, and then the next one is Psalms. Where does Esther fall in the story, those of you that know the story?
Exile.
Yeah, exile. It's kind of like the end of the Old Testament story. Where does Job kind of fall?
Very early.
Very, very early. Close to Abraham. Ish. Right? And then Psalms. Where does Psalms fall?
It's a big range.
It's a very big range. Exactly. It overlaps across almost the entire biblical story. Right? We have Psalms of Moses, and we have Psalms that say, by the rivers of Babylon. And that was in our Bonnie end. Okay, so, no? Okay, some of you get it?
I know what you're talking about.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, at least some of you get it. Okay, and so we have these 3 books right next to each other, and they don't map to a story. This is the end, this is somewhere near the beginning, and this is all over the place. So what's important for us to know as we're reading through our Bibles is actually how the Old Testament is arranged. And it's much easier then to talk about how the New Testament is arranged. Okay?
Jerry, isn't Song of Solomon in the 5 there?
It is, you're right. Sorry. Good point.
Song of Solomon's after.
Yeah. And then actually Lamentations also kinds of overlaps with it. Lamentations overlaps with it as well. But we'll talk about that later. So, okay. A Song of Songs, a Song of Solomon. All right, so what we need to do is, by the way, today's October 1st.
Yes.
How many of us have read the whole Bible, by the way? Cover to cover? Cover to cover?
Ever, even?
Yeah, ever in your life. Okay. So here's a good thing. Today's October 1st. If you start reading your Bible today, take out your phones. If you use your phones, there's an app called the Bible app, YouVersion. You can download a plan called the 90-day reading plan. It's a commitment for about an hour and 20 minutes every day. You can finish reading the whole Bible, cover to cover, before the end of the year. Cover to cover. Some of us have actually done the 90-day reading plan. Those of us who's done a 90-day reading plan?
Almost done.
Almost done? The first time you go through it, you're going to go, I have no idea what's going on. And that's okay. Your body's just going to go through shock because you've never read that much in your life. Right? That's all you're doing. All you're doing is you're saying, I am going to get to the finish line. Sometimes your mind's going to wander and go, I don't remember what I just read. That's okay. Just keep reading. Right? And so, you know Dory? She says, just keep swimming. Just keep swimming. Just keep reading. All right? Just keep reading. Get to the finish line. And then in the new year, start over again. Once you start over again, your mind and your body's not going to be in shock anymore. And then you're going to start actually getting what's going on. You're just going to get used to the pace. By your 3rd or 4th time is when you're going to start seeing connections. And you're going to start seeing, oh, this is actually a full story, cover to cover. And it's all connected. But unless you actually do something like that, it's like taking a movie and watching 365 parts of it. By the time you get to December 31st, you're not even going to know what the movie was about. Right? You're never, like, even a book. You take any book. If you divide this book into 365 parts and you start January 1st and you try to end December 31st, you're not going to have any idea what the book's about. But we tend to do that with the Bible. Because we don't realize, and we may not have been taught, that it's actually one story and one plot. And so what I want to do today is not give you an academic exercise of how to dissect a Bible like you dissect the Bible like you dissect a frog. Because the moment you dissect a frog, the frog's dead. Right? Isn't that true?
Hopefully it's dead before.
Well, you know for sure. You know for sure it's dead. Well, not everybody dissects a dead frog, by the way. Right? Not everybody dissects a dead frog. But once you've dissected it, there's no going back, right? Like, you're not going to see that frog in action. So I'm not here to dissect the Bible. I'm here to help you actually see how it works so that when you start reading the Bible, you actually see how it works. All right? I don't want to turn it into an academic exercise. However, it's important for you to know some of the mechanisms. It's important for you to know some of the mechanisms of how the books work. So that when you read your Bible, you're not going to be confused. Okay? We're going to go through the first 17 books. The first 17 books you can call narrative books. Now, it may not be an official academic term, and we're not going to use academic terms today. We're just going to use terms that are going to help us. The first 17 books are narrative books. What's narrative? Narrative is a genre, right? It actually describes the kind of material in those books. What is narrative usually? What kind of things do I see in narrative?
Storytelling?
Story, yeah, it's storytelling. It's actually storytelling, right? So the 17 books are narrative. So I start with Genesis exactly. The simplest answers, okay? And then I get to chapter 50 and I ask the question, what happens next? And you would say to me, go to Exodus, all right? And I go to Exodus, and I ask the question, what happens next? And you're going to say?
Leviticus.
Actually, Leviticus. And I'll tell you why. I used to think it was Numbers, but it's Leviticus. I have to correct all of the years that I've taught it incorrectly. I'm learning too, okay? And then Leviticus, I ask what happens next. Numbers, I ask what happens next.
Joshua.
It's Joshua. And I'll tell you why. Because what happens in Deuteronomy is kind of an interlude between Numbers and Joshua. So it's kind of the end of Numbers when the people are going to end their wandering in the wilderness and Moses has a bunch of things to teach them again, this new generation, before they go into the land. And whatever he's telling them closes off the Torah. And it overlays itself on the entire Old Testament. So if you don't understand something in the Old Testament, you go to Genesis or Exodus or Leviticus or Numbers or Deuteronomy, and it will explain it to you. If there's something that looks random, I guarantee you, it's explained over there. As random as little boys make fun of Elisha, you bald-headed men, and bears come and eat them up. That's seemingly random, isn't it? It's explained in Moses' writing. A mom telling the king, yesterday we eat her son, today she wants to eat, yesterday we eat my son, and today we want to eat her son, but she won't let us cook her son alive. It's in Leviticus. All right? So anything that looks random, it's all explained in Moses. Moses is the measure for every other prophet. If they don't measure up to Moses, they're a false prophet. All right? So every prophet and every writing has to measure up to Moses. So Deuteronomy closes that off. What happens next is Joshua. What happens next?
Judges.
Judges. What happens next?
First Samuel.
First Samuel. Okay, what happens next? Second Samuel. Okay, what happens next?
First Kings.
First Kings. What happens next?
Second Kings.
Second Kings. What happens next?
Ezra. Chronicles is like a repeating of the Kings. So I'm thinking it's Ezra.
You are correct, because there actually is a narrative that's embedded in Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel that goes into the last 17. So this part of the story is actually missing in the narrative, because they go into exile. And then what happens next, you're right, is Ezra. What happens next?
Nehemiah.
Nehemiah. What happens next?
I mean, there's Esther.
Mm-hmm.
And then Matthew.
So Esther doesn't happen next. Esther happens in parallel. Okay? So after Nehemiah, there's no more story. The story kind of pauses. Then the story picks up in Matthew. Between Nehemiah and Matthew, there's a lot of history written, which isn't part of Scripture. It's in the apocryphal books, but it's not part of Scripture. But if you wanted to read what actually happened between Nehemiah and Matthew, it's there. Right? So after Nehemiah, the next thing that happens then, in terms of story, is the New Testament. So whenever you're going through the narrative books, you ask the question, what happens next? And you're going to find the next, what I call a time book. A time book. But there are other books also that give us more details. And those books are, not academic terms, color books. Right? They give us more color on the situation. So for example, if I'm in Judges and I say, let's zoom in on a story that's relevant to the big story of the Bible, where would I go? Which book? Not Genesis, during Judges. It's during Judges, during the time of Judges. The book starts with when the judges judged.
Is that Ruth?
That is Ruth, exactly. Right? So, we have some color books, right, that we've missed over here. So, Deuteronomy is one of those. It doesn't answer the question, what happens next. Another one is Ruth. And then I should do a plus, not a... And then, First and Second Chronicles. And then, we have Esther. Okay? So, if you read Deuteronomy, you're not going to read what happens next. If you read Ruth, you're not going to read what happens next. If you read First and Second Chronicles, they don't tell you what happens after 1st and 2nd Kings. It gives you a different plot, a version of the plot, or a different angle on the plot. So it's like the camera switches sides. It goes from camera 1 to camera 2. Because it wants to focus in on a specific theology of 1st and 2nd Kings. And then Esther talks about some of the people that were not in the land when a certain group went with Ezra and Nehemiah to the land, a certain group did not. And Esther gives us one camera view into their life. All right? So for any questions with what we've seen or what we're considering? Not all at once, please. No? Okay.
Just a question.
Yes.
There's 15... in those books that you have there, but it's
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, 100, 101, 102, 103, 104, 105, 106, 107, 108, 109, 110, 111, 112, 113, 114, 115, 116, 117, 118, 119, 120, 121, 122, 123, 124, 125, No, sorry, 11, 12,
oh.
13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Don't consider these, because this is part of the prophets.
Oh, okay.
This is part of the prophets. So we have 17. Let's try it again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And so we're going to consider then what happens with the five probably tomorrow, and then Isaiah to Malachi are prophets. And even those, yes.
Do you think that it's ever helpful to read the Bible in chronological order?
But how do you know what the chronology is?
I mean, just going off of a chronological reading plan, I guess.
And how do they know? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Did someone with a top hat, a mustache, and a monocle tell them how to read it?
Yes.
Huh? Right? So, I would say that if it was meant to be read chronologically, it would have been arranged chronologically. And it's not. And so, what's going to happen is it's like a play or a movie or a show. If you were to say, I don't like what the director did, let me now take all of this, let me splice it down into its individual scenes. And I don't care what the acts were, I am going to now rearrange it so I understand what truly happened behind there, right? So an exercise for chronological reading, if I had to take you behind the scenes a little bit, comes from a question, usually, of what actually happened versus what is the director of the movie telling me, right? And if we try to reverse engineer the movie and say, I can figure out what actually happened and I don't really need the director's editing or cut, then what I'm saying is, I don't really like the point of what he's saying. Let me make a judgment call for myself of what actually happened historically. It comes back further to the question of inspiration. Does inspiration lie in the historical events, or does it lie in the telling of the historical events? Right? That's the fundamental theological question. Does it lie in the historical events, or does it lie in the telling of the historical events? And what I present to you is that the inspired word is the telling of the historical events and not the historical events themselves. Right? And so it's very important for us not just to read it in the order, that it's given to us, but also ask the question, why is this author giving these details to us and not those other details that probably the other author has given us? What's the theological point they're driving through? And it's very important once we get to the New Testament, because we have four Gospels. And what people tend to do with four Gospels is they tend to harmonize it. But it's like taking three different Batman movies and saying, I want to know the real Batman, so I'm going to like blend all of the movies together. You're never going to find the real Batman by blending three movies together. You're just going to have a mishmash of three different Batman movies. Right? And so it's very important for us to say, do the historical events contain inspiration? Or does the telling actually have the inspired word? And is there a theological point to the telling that we need to understand? Right? So a lot of biblical studies, New Testament studies, Old Testament studies, try to look behind the text. And what I'm trying to encourage today is we have to look at the text. Is that fair?
So you're saying it's more helpful, or it's better to read the Bible from front to back, but then to know kind of what's going on
Yes.
in the book that you're reading.
Because that's going to now help us ask the question, why is God telling me this in the way he's telling it to me, right? Because I know the big story, but why is he telling it to me in this way? Right? That's very, very important. For example, once we get to Exodus, I'm going to show you some interesting ways in which he's telling a story in Exodus, but actually he's telling it to us like Genesis 1. So he could have told us those stories in any way, but he's actually giving us the telling of these stories just the way he told us the story in Genesis 1. So this is why I actually gave some people the plot mountain thing, because I was like, this is perfect. I've been trying to tell people about the plot, and we need to read the Bible as a full plot. Yes?
It might be like a little more of a tangent question, on the terms of inspiration and the order of the books, is the order of the books that we have in the Bible right now is inspired versus like, You just mentioned that the original Jews had it in a different order. You know, that during the time of the Bible, there were just like letters kind of spread around. Yeah. And it was kind of like that version of the Greek that kind of got to peace.
Yeah.
Do we claim then also the inspiration was through that order?
Nobody claims order has inspiration. Everybody claims that the telling of the text has inspiration. So the thing with chronological Bible is the chronological Bible actually chops books up. So you're reading a book and all of a sudden, like the Psalms will come in. Or you're reading Genesis, all of a sudden Job enters the scene. And he's not supposed to be on the scene over there. But he walks in and he gives us his lines and he walks out. And then Abraham comes back on, confused. He's like, I don't know what just happened. I don't know why Job entered the scene right now. Right? So that's what the chronological Bible is.
The book complete on its own, like that's the story told, but like the arrangement of the books in certain order, that's...
Nobody claims that the arrangement of the books are inspired. No. But the telling of the books are inspired, and splitting a book up and inserting another book in order to understand the story behind the scene may be good educationally, but it's not something that lends to why we actually read the Bible as a sacred text, which is forming Christ in us, understanding the character of God, and edifying the saints. Yes, sir.
So I think, to clarify, chronological, I know there are some reading plans that they don't splice up the book itself, but they'll say Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, they'll basically do the stuff on the left, the narratives, right?
Yep.
I guess a follow-up question to Rebecca, is there any profit in doing that? So we understand the entire...
Yeah, okay. That's fair.
Okay.
But don't splice up a book.
Right, that's fair.
The arrangements of the book in the Bible are not inspired. Right? But the book itself is a complete work.
Right. The order of each word from the start of the book to the end, that is inspired.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. And you also have to look at book collections. So what I mean is Genesis through Deuteronomy is a collection. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Don't break it up. It's a collection. And that's the foundation of everything in Scripture. You want to understand Revelation? Where's the first place you're going to go to? Genesis through Deuteronomy. Genesis through Deuteronomy will help me understand the earlier prophets, and it's good former prophets. Then it's going to help me understand the latter prophets. It's going to help me understand the wisdom books. It's going to help me understand the Gospels. It's going to help me understand the epistles. It's going to help me understand Revelation. Right? And so unless I realize that that's the foundation, and then there's building up on top of that, the Bible's going to be very, very confusing for me. So keep the groups together at least. Even if you're doing a chronological order, keep the groups together, because Moses has a point that he's driving from the beginning of Genesis to the end of Deuteronomy, actually. And that's very, very important to see. All right?
And that answers that question.
Yes.
And to clarify, when you say that the telling of the story versus what actually happened is important, you're not saying that the story is fiction.
It's not fiction.
Something actually happened.
Correct.
But the point is to really understand what happened. You want to, I think I understand what you're saying. Stuff has happened.
Yes.
But the text is arranged. The story is presented a certain way in order to teach something about Christ. And it assumes, it's not even about, like, we value history, right, historical events.
Yeah.
It assumes that these things have happened.
Yep.
But the point is, don't just stop there. Look, here's what I'm trying to show you about what has happened.
Yep.
Is that fair to...
That is fair. And not just that, the assumption when you read the Bible as a sacred text is you're already assuming that it's true. You're not reading, like, the Bible doesn't try and prove itself to be true to you. Right? So if there's an unbeliever asking a question, I would answer very differently. I am now speaking with, I'm assuming that the class has believers, and I'm speaking to believers, and I'm saying the Bible doesn't try to prove itself. It has arranged, it is written in a certain way to communicate a certain something to believers. So we don't try to read it apologetically to say, okay, I need to first prove that it's true before I can actually understand what it's saying. We don't approach the text like that as believers. We approach it saying it's already true. We assume that it's rooted in history, but the author of the text is drawing our attention to only specific details and specific movements in all of history. many dialogues have happened in history. Many people have lived in history. Many things have been thought. Many things have been said. Many things have been done. Not everything is contained in the Bible. Very specific things are contained in the Bible. And those specific things are contained because those are relevant to the point of the author and the point that they're driving to. And as readers, we have to ask the question, what is the author trying to tell us? Right? And from what the author is trying to tell us, the next question is, what is its implication for the reader, not trying to tell us, trying to tell the readers, and then what are the implications for us? And so even as we read the book, what I'm going into is hermeneutics. I don't want to get into that. Stop inserting yourself into the story. Right? So when God's speaking to Abraham, God is not speaking to you, even though your name might be Abraham. He's speaking to a specific individual named Abraham that lived at a certain time in a certain place. So it's very, very important that when we read it, we have to read it as the author telling us that there was a conversation happening between party A and party B, and we're party C observing that. Okay? So even as we get through, it's also important for us to ask questions about how stories work. So I gave you a little printout, right? And it says it's plot mounting. So I wanted to actually, let's see if I can play it. And this is important when we actually read a, so if you have the lyrics, this guy's not very.
If you're going to Plot Mountain, you gotta start somewhere. We'll call this the introduction. And guess what happens there? You describe the characters and the settings. That's who, what, when, and where. The characters are the people that are there. What do they look like? Why should we care? And the setting is the place where they be. What exactly do the characters see on their way to Plot Mountain? At the start of Plot Mountain, you're gonna have to go up. We call this the rising action, and here starts the plot. There's a conflict in the story. You should describe exactly what. Like a character has a problem to work through with themselves or the world, what should they do? Or maybe there's some big arguments or some dramatic natural events on the way up Plot Mountain. Keep going up Plot Mountain until you reach the top. We call this the climax, and here you cannot stop. You must face the biggest problem that leads to a turning point. Here the story is the most intense, with emotions, drama, and suspense. But action like this cannot stay. The story must change and go a different way on the top of Cloud Mountain. After the top of Plot Mountain, you're gonna start to go down. We call this the falling action, and it lasts until flat ground. There's still action in the story, but it will start to slow down. So the worst is over, yeah, the worst is through, but now what will the characters do? There are still some problems, how long will they last? And don't forget, the ending is coming fast on the way down Plot Mountain. After climbing down Plot Mountain, well, it's gotta end somewhere. We call this the resolution, and what will happen there? You should answer all the questions until you are aware that the conflicts in the story from before aren't there anymore. Unless there's gonna be a sequel or a part two, and then you'll have to think, what will the characters do the next time on Plot Mountain?
Yeah. So we don't think around Plot Mountain type of thinking when it comes to the Bible, right? Whenever we think of the Plot Mountain, we have, what's the first part called?
Introduction.
Introduction and setting, yeah. Then we have
rising
action. What's at the top?
Climax.
Then what do we have?
Falling
action. And then what do we have?
Resolution.
So we have the intro and setting. What leads to rising action? What happens here?
Conflict.
Conflict, yeah. there's some problem that happens in the story. And then we have rising action. What's the purpose of rising action? Also,
to build to the big conflict.
So that's the climax. But what else does the rising action do? What other purpose does it serve?
To fix the conflict.
What else?
Adds more backstory.
Yeah, to?
To the whole plot.
Okay. How does it do that?
To build tension.
Well, the tension's building, yes. But what's happening with the backstory? It doesn't tell us everything about in the backstory. It doesn't tell us, unless it's relevant. So what is it doing with the backstory?
Pulling out the main issues.
Okay, why?
Because they're going to be relevant to the climax and resolution.
Okay, it's relevant to something else as well. And how is it relevant to the climax and resolution? Has anyone watched Slumdog Millionaire? Yeah?
The only two Indian guys. Yeah.
Such a cliche. Such a cliche. It was in English, okay, it won an Oscar. Okay, I can't use that.
Is it a continuation of, there's the intro, but it's a continuation of that story? I don't know.
So the other thing that rising action does, what all of you said is correct. So there's backstory. So there's issues. It's relevant to climax. But what is all of this to do with? It actually has to do with character. Character development. Whose character? Whose character? No, just
the main character.
Yeah, what are they called?
Protagonists.
So protagonists, right. Right? So it has to do with character development of the protagonist. Maybe even the antagonist. Maybe even the antagonist. And also kind of the extras and supporting actors, right? Support. Extras nobody cares about. Okay, they do that. Right, so there's protagonist, antagonist, and then there's supporting characters. All of them, through the rising action, show certain characters of the protagonist. Yes? And so through the little conflicts that happen, there's maybe building character, maybe the protagonist is learning things, or the protagonist is demonstrating aspects of their character that would not have been shown in the setting and introduction. Does that make sense so far?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And so, when it comes to the Bible, who's the protagonist?
Jesus?
No. Yes, but it's a partial answer.
Oh, wait, the Godhead.
Yeah, the Godhead. God is it's a partial answer. I can't say no, because Jesus is God. Right? But God is the protagonist. Why? Because he's the constant character right through. What's the conflict? So what's the intro and setting?
Genesis. Creation.
Yeah. Genesis 1 and 2. What's the conflict?
Genesis
3. Yep. Fall sin. What's the climax?
Jesus' crucifixion?
No. Because there's still stuff that happens after that that's still going on.
Oh, I thought that was the downfall until Jesus returns.
No.
Oh, okay.
Revelation 19 and 20. And then there is the falling action. The falling action is also known as the denouement, right? Which is where all the loose ends are tied up. Falling action.
So this, the age of the church is falling action.
No, this is the...
Oh, sorry.
The millennium kingdom. All right, and then this is the end when Satan is destroyed. Final destruction. Satan's and death's final destruction. Right? And so what's happening from Genesis 3 to Revelation 19 and 20 is the rising action. Right? And we're still part of the rising action right now. We're headed towards the climax of the story. Now, here's a question. Which is the most important part of the story?
That's a trick question. They're all important.
Yes, correct. Okay? So when people start talking about things like, oh yeah, as long as you're okay with the primary things like, you know, like the rising action of what happened with the cross, you can disagree about Genesis. You can disagree about the falling action as long as you're okay with one item in the rising action. How does that sound to you about a story or a plot?
It's not a bad story.
But we tend to divide the Bible into like primary issues, secondary issues, and all of those things. Right? You could believe in evolution or you could believe in a six-day creation. It's not relevant as long as you're okay with the cross. You see how people think about issues in the Bible? They've divided up because they don't realize that all of the books actually contribute to this story. And they're all important because if you have a different idea of what the conflict and the problem is, you're going to have a problem with a different idea of what the resolution and the climax and the solution is. If sin and the fall is not the conflict, then the resolution, the rising action, and the climax has nothing to do with Satan, has nothing to do with the death of death, and has nothing to do with, you know, the rule of man once again through Jesus Christ. Well, rule of God through Jesus Christ once again. Right? So it's very important that we actually understand that the stories that we're reading actually follow this plot. And not just individual stories or episodes, like you're watching a TV show. It's one big story. Okay? What I want to do next week is I actually want to go through those books now to show you in the Old Testament, to show you how the story works and how the plot's actually working through the larger story of the Bible. Right? And we're going to, and I hope that at the end of tomorrow's class, we don't actually understand all of the Bible, but it sets us on a path to start reading the Bible correctly. We're not going to have 66 books in 2 hours. That's impossible, right? I'll plan for a continuation into the rest of the Old Testament and the New Testament for the winter, but we're not going to cover all of this in just 2 classes. But it's very important that at least once you start reading the Bible this spring, because you're all going to do the 90-day plan. I'm joking. No. Don't give up the plans you have if you already have a reading plan. But if you don't have a reading plan and you want to complete the Bible in the next 90 days, the 90-day reading plan is great. Follows a plot line. And it's all connected. And it's all relevant to one another. And one of the problems we have, not the Bible, is we haven't started asking the question of how does this story actually connect to the stories before and the story after. So sometimes we read things and we're like, you know what? This may not be relevant information. Let's move on. That's because we don't realize how it actually connects right through the story. And once we start realizing it, we start realizing, oh man, this thing is actually much tighter, and this story that I thought was irrelevant, or this genealogy that I thought was not relevant, is actually connected and embedded into the story. And it's very, very important. So I'm hoping that our classes will help us start reading the Bible a different way. Any questions or comments? I don't want to go over today. No? All right. If you don't have anything, I'm going to actually start going. Yes. Okay, good. Thank you.
I did have a question.
Yes.
So it seems to me that you are bringing an assumption to the text that it's arranged in this, that this structure exists. Is there a way you can derive these pieces from the text? Because it seems like, so Emma and myself actually, even though I didn't say, thought the climax is the cross, right?
Yep.
So it seems like we're applying the label after reading the text.
Correct.
Can you derive these labels from within the text?
Yes. Yes, and it's because most people have no idea how the climax is actually, because we've been so embedded in reading the Gospels, and there is a climax in the Gospels, which is the crucifixion of Jesus, we think that that's the climax. But that's the climax of one of the rising action scenes. It's not the climax of the entire story. So if you read one of the stories and you see a climax, that's not the climax of the entire Bible. So two things have contributed to that thought process. One is a constant repeat, which is not wrong, that Christ is the point and the center of the Bible. It's not wrong. But when we think of Christ, what does everybody think of? Just the gospel story accounts. But Christ is not contained to just the gospel accounts. We have to then ask the question, everything else we read of Christ into Revelation, how does that work? How does the climax of Revelation, where does that fit? Is it a climax in a falling action? How does falling action have such a global climax? Right? That doesn't fit. So there are a few ways to do it, but the way I'm teaching it is, yeah, the global climax is the global realization of what happened in one of the events of the rising action, which is a big event. It's a major event. But that major event now qualifies the protagonist to do what they're doing over here. Otherwise, the protagonist is not qualified to do what they're doing over here, namely, taking authority over all of the earth in an actualized sense, right? And destroying evil. They don't have that authority until the cross and the resurrection actually took place.
I think for us, it's more comfortable to be there because we see the crucifixion and resurrection in our rearview mirror, right? Where it's
correct.
Harder to see forward the future as the climax yet to come.
Yeah, we're still here in the story. We think we're here and everything's good, or maybe somewhere here. And what's our future? Everybody believes. This is rhetoric, okay? Everybody believes that once we die, we're going to be floating around on clouds like Casper the Friendly Ghost, playing harps, and that's what it is. That's our future. That's a very boring future. And I don't want it to have anything to do with that. This life looks much more interesting and fun than floating around on clouds and playing harps for the rest of eternity. Right? But because we actually don't even know what the rest of the story looks like, a lot of people have nothing greater to set their affections on than the pleasures that this world gives. Because this seems so much better than what's going to come. But if we are able to realize that what's going to come, what we have today is nothing compared to what's going to come. And that taking something small here is like Esau saying, you know what? I'll give up all of my birthright, just give me the pot of stew. That's all I want. I'll give everything else up, just give me the pot of stew. Going after the things and the allures of this world is the equivalent of Esau saying, forget the birthright, forget the blessings, just give me the pot of stew. But we don't realize what the birthright and the blessings and all of those things are because we don't actually know what the rest of the story is. And so knowing the story is also going to help us in our sanctification. Because we realize that the things that are right in front of us are very tiny compared to the greatness that is coming and the glory that is coming. And so suffering today is very, very small compared to what's up yet ahead. That's Romans 8, right? And we're starting that. And so knowing this also helps with that. And you're right. 2020, we look back at everything that's happened, but no one's actually given us, you know, a mall marker to say, you are here. Right? If we knew that, then we're like, oh, okay, the climax is coming up soon, very, very soon. Right? And we wait for that. And while the conflict's going on, we continue the conflict. Right? In the rising action. Make sense? All right. We're at 10:01. We overshot the runway. We'll pray, and then I'll hang around over here if there are any questions. Father, we're grateful for this time. We're grateful for your kindness to us. We're grateful for your word. We're grateful that you've laid out to the shame of your enemies your battle plans. You've laid out your grand program, and you've done that. You did that in the Gospels. You did that in the Old Testament. Lord, you have shown that none of your plans are a secret because no one's going to be able to thwart it. Our confidence is in the fact that you have called us to be on your side. But Lord, our humility is that if it was apart from your grace and your mercy to us, Lord, if you do not set your affection and your love on us, if you didn't call us to be your people, Lord, where would we be? Lord, we would be those trampled underfoot by the victorious conquering king, the enemy that is to be fed to the lake of fire, destroyed and shown off as a byproduct of your victory over sin and death. But Lord, today, as your children here this Sunday morning, we want to thank you that you would allow us to be part of the group that the victorious king leads to victory. Those that have been cleansed by his sacrifice on the cross. And Lord, our desire is that he may receive the glory of his suffering. He may receive the glory that is due to him for his death and for his resurrection. And may that glory be seen in our midst today and in your community, Lord, in the week ahead. We thank you for the heads that are bowed, Lord. And set our eyes on the city with foundations. Set our eyes on the glory that is coming. And Lord, may the tantalizing draws of our flesh and of the world be as minimal and as irrelevant as a cup of stew. And Lord, let us not trade what is glorious and great for what is temporary and small. We thank you for your kindness to us. Even as we gather, may our praises, may our reading, may our prayer, may our remembrance at the table, and may our listening to your word be for your glory and honor. And may those that don't know you see your people do this and say that God is truly in this place. We can't wait for you to return. We can't wait for the rest of the program of this great plot and of how you will establish your kingdom here on earth in its finality. We thank you and we praise you in Jesus Christ, Lord's precious name. Amen.
Thanks,
Jerry.
Is it all going?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. It's an apple press, a big apple. It is so good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
Oh,
that's
so good.
I've never had
it. Someone else
has that
big apple, like apple press.
Somebody who had apple
press.
Like,
it's awesome. We'll have to go another time. You can find another one.
We took an hour.
But they have all the little ones.
Exactly. And it was understandable.
It's not an excuse. It's not an acceptable excuse.
Use it as an excuse.
I know. When I can, that's true.
Oh, well,